Welcome to our CCAS Research Podcast, Inquiring Minds, Mending Tiny Hearts. I am thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Todd Kilbaugh from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Todd is a pediatric cardiac intensivist and anesthesiologist with a remarkable track record in translational and device-related research. He has worked at the intersection of clinical care, engineering, and industry to help bring innovative technologies into the ICU and operating room. In this episode, we'll talk about how industry partnerships shape device development, what opportunities and challenges they create for investigators, and what advice Todd has for early career researchers considering this path. Todd, thank you so much for joining me today, and maybe we could start off by you telling us how you first became involved in device and industry research.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I think my journey really started in residency when I started working in bioengineering, and my interest really was, why were things not translating to the bedside, both from device development and from a therapeutic development to children? Why was there so little FDA applications and ultimately success in commercialization? And my original sort of piece was really around therapeutics. So I spent a lot of time working on developing large animal models for therapeutic development and sort of to speed translation, because especially for CNS, neuroprotection and neurorecovery, there really just seemed to be nothing going from rodents to humans. And I thought that was really a problem and a chasm for that. So as I started to build out these models, I got interested in not only just the therapeutic development, from small molecules, large molecules, more I saw a true need for large animal models and translational into clinical, having the ability to create both investigational drug packages for the FDA submissions, but also for investigational device development for FDA indications in children. And so we were very lucky that we were able to start to develop collaborators around those sort of things and to really then look at diagnostics, devices, and therapeutics. And so that's led to the creation of our center called the Resuscitation Science Center that really focuses on this preclinical stage of helping both investigators and now industry, as you said, to take their ideas and move them from a rapid translational piece towards the FDA and then into children.
Are there certain devices that are better suited for this type of work? Like you said you started in therapeutics. Is a therapeutic device easier than diagnostic?
No. So I think they all have different FDA pathways, which get very confusing. And I think a lot of times when people sort of think about these things, like how am I going to push something towards actual commercialization, is that you have to figure out there's a way to get paid for it and then if there's a true indication for it. So that sort of goes into sort of this idea of when you're first writing these grants as a junior faculty member, like what is sort of the chess moves that I need to do to ultimately get things towards a patient, right? Especially in device, there are all kinds of regulatory pieces that need to be looked at. And there's a lot of great funding opportunities both within the NIH as well as the Department of Defense, which I think most pediatric investigators don't really think about. But the Department of Defense funds a lot of pediatric stuff, especially in the device space. And I think trying to understand, oh, I've got a great idea. I've got, whether it's a therapeutic, a device, or a diagnostic, I've got a great idea. But how do I create the science around it that also has some, we'll call it business acumen, that allows you to understand that there are stages of development that you need to hit to actually get it to a patient?
So in those stages of development, is the FDA that you work with them? Say for example, you're doing an NIH grant to do a device development. How does the FDA play into that?
So for those sort of things, you can always apply for what's called a pre-IND or a pre-IDE meeting with the FDA that allows you to get some advice on what you would need to do to before you're allowed to create a package. Now, there is a lot of consulting around this. You can pay lots of money. There are people that are experts in this to do that. And I think more and more, like within institutions, there's this realization that overall dollars and reimbursement are for our clinical work has started to either go flat or go down. So most major institutions now are looking at how they can create new revenue. And so this idea of device development, entrepreneurship, all of that is really changing in a lot of these universities. So at Penn, there's Penn Health Tech, which is really a sort of incubator space for new ideas. And they're really starting to encourage junior investigators or people that even haven't done science, but they just have a great idea that they want to sort of see move forward, whether that is something that's a device or a software or something else. And so I think this sort of innovation aspect is really changing within universities in general. Some have been very good at it for long periods of time, like Stanford and the University of Michigan, the Cleveland Clinic, for example. Penn is starting to catch up in that aspect and really doing a great job, I think. And so is, and CHOP is also trying to like find their way into that that avenue. So I think my best advice for junior investigators is if you have a good idea and you're starting to work on those things, really try to look at where you can get help, because oftentimes they will then, you apply to these programs, it's usually not a ton of money, but they have a lot of good people in industry that are interested in helping you move your ideas forward, and they can give you great advice on how did you deal with the FDA, what are your steps in, even if you want to start an outside company, what would that look like? But most of it is you really need to understand that you need help. Like, great ideas are one thing, but you need teams of people that do this or have done this for a living that can really help you drive your innovation forward.
How early in the process do you have to think about intellectual property and applying for a patent?
As early as possible. You know, it's sort of like vote early, vote often, right? Like, the second you think you have something that's patentable, you need to put in work with your Office of Tech Transfer to start having discussions. Even if it's a napkin drawing of something that you think, okay, well, I think this is going to be revolutionize this, and I'm willing to like really start to, you know, work on probably your own time, your free time to start work on this. Find passion around it. Talk to your tech transfer early.
And then you talked about DOD and NIH funding for device development, but what about industry funding? Can you talk a little bit about how those relationships get started and what that looks like?
Yeah. So I've been fairly successful, I would say, with my funding lines, because I kind of look at them how I manage my own personal finance. I try to keep a balanced portfolio around my federal funding as well as my non-federal funding. And what I mean by that is within the NIH, multiple different structures, whether that's NNDS or NHLBI or others, within using the Department of Defense, I think is also incredibly important. And then when it comes to industry, really, I think for me, the industry platforms have come because I haven't necessarily initially sought it out. I was really doing it as of, I had all these amazing models that could help people move things forward. And then as I gave talks, as I became a fund investigators in the Department of Defense and NIH, companies would go to them, and then those companies would then send them to me and say, hey, listen, this person's a good scientist, they understand commercialization, you should talk to them, and you can find a way to be helpful to each other to move your ideas forward. So that's one way. And I think the other way is just to, if you are interested in these type of things, reach out to some of these companies. You know, the device space in particular is a very interesting space with commercialization. So the commercial side of devices is really dominated by a small set of companies, really, medical device. And I would say in the past, they have oftentimes will work on an idea with an investigator. But that's sort of as funding lines and venture capital has sort of contracted and those sort of things. When it comes to a device, usually now what they're really looking for is that there's something that's FDA approved, and probably even more importantly, that it's FDA approved and has some market already in terms of it's used in a couple different hospitals, that there's like a real true cash flow that they can then model a return on investment on. So for the investigator, if you've got your own technology and you want to move that forward, it means that whether this is at Hopkins or this is at Seattle or this is in Chicago or this is in Texas, at your institution, finding ways to create some with your innovation hub that's there to get towards these things allows you to ultimately create a relationship or X license with or sell to a company like Johnson & Johnson MedTech or Stryker or Medtronic, etc. And I think that the other piece of that is ultimately it's very unlikely you're going to take your idea all the way to the bedside. But it's not likely. But the creativity comes from you. The creativity is, I've got this idea, I can drive this from a creative aspect, and then not to be so myopic thinking that you're the only one that can drive it, that you need help, that you need people that understand regulatory, they understand commercialization, and you probably also have another full-time job, and that's either being a clinician or a PhD level scientist at a university and understanding that your time is limited too with those things. So finding help. And then I think the most important part of that is you really just have to be passionate and believe in it. So if you're interested in working with industry, if you have a particular set of skills, looking at the companies that are doing that, both small and large, and even just reaching out and saying, hey, I'm really interested in what you're doing, how you're doing it. I'm wondering how we can create a relationship so that I could work with you on this, either on the clinical side or the preclinical side, to move your technology forward.
Are there differences when you're doing the actual science and the actual projects? Are there differences in how that goes when the funding comes from industry versus NIH or DOD?
For sure. So to make it simple, I will say there, when you look at the federal funding side, there's either pure scientific grants that are there to support you as a principal investigator or your team as an investigative team. And whether that is for a therapeutic or that's understanding the mechanism of action for a particular sodium channel in the brain or a particular device, that's very scientifically driven. There's the other aspects both within, and that's whether that's DOD or NIH, it doesn't really matter. Then there's other aspects within the Department of Defense, like groups called MTEC, which are really the small business innovation side of the Department of Defense, or small business innovation grants, or which are called SBIRs, or STTRs for technology translation. Those are really built for small business in this country to help them move forward as a company. Now that requires you having a company, right? And that can be, what that company looks like can be a LLC that's a virtual company, but it has to have at least an employee in it, that, and there are some rules and regulations around those things and blah, blah, blah. But you can be a university employee and also have companies, right? You have to explain your conflict and those sort of things. But so there's a pure scientific grant. There are business innovation grants for small companies that and ideas that you can go after. And then ultimately, then there's the industry-sponsored stuff. Now, if industry is sponsoring you as a clinician scientist or a scientist within the institution, then it gets it's complicated, but important. And so how you manage conflict, how you manage risk, what the IP is between both the company and the university have to be worked out. Usually, if it's a company that already has a well-established IP around it, they can often give you what's called a contract service grant, where you will perform the research with their device or even their therapeutic or their diagnostic that allows them to move forward towards either, again, an IDE or IND application, or helps them in the clinical space or with their own commercialization. And essentially what you're getting is you're helping to bring that to patients. You're getting dollars from in terms of to support your time, your research infrastructure, and those sort of things. And the individual universities are getting indirect dollars, right? And so that's really the capital reimbursement. Now, there are some stages, companies that are so early that they are willing to give up IP or joint IP. And that's where your Office of Tech Transfer and those sort of things come in, and the relationship with you have with them is important, because ultimately they will make the final decision about what those contracts look like, because they want to mitigate risk. They want to mitigate risk to patients themselves, and they also don't want to give up the idea that, well, if we're using our resources and our people's minds and those sort of things, we may deserve some intellectual property down the stream. So it really comes into your relationship with Office of Tech Transfer then to how that works. And I think in your balanced portfolio as an investigator, if you can have some of those relationships with industry, A, they're very important, because you're helping them move forward, because ultimately the biggest thing we want is for kids to actually have these things and to be able to improve their outcomes. And two, a lot of times the way that we structure all of our agreements is that the data that we collect is actually ours. The IP may be theirs, but it's a way that you're creating your own preliminary data for things that you may be interested in scientifically or your own things, and then it just gives both data and dollars that keep you balanced in your portfolio that allow you to do more.
Yeah, that's very, very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
In the near future, what devices do you think we're going to be coming for congenital cardiac anesthesia that if someone who wanted to look into this and start reaching out to industry partners, where should they start? Like, where do you think the future is for our field?
Well, I'm a carpenter who sees a nail, and I see there are lots of devices out there that will, whether that's for lymphatic procedures or that is for more non-invasive aspects of cardiac care, in terms of cath lab versus an operating room, when we've already seen it, like how we, you know, have evolved to hybrid suites and things like that. And if you can play out what's happening in adults, whether that's from extracorporeal support or, you know, valve replacements and things like that, so much of this now has become more and more, quote unquote, non-invasive. And so that will happen for sure. How we handle VAD support and other things as things become miniaturized, and how we use devices that are Impella-like and all that kind of stuff, I think is going to revolutionize things. But for me, it's really the brain, right? It's really like, how do we get these kids through all of these things that we do to them, and both either prenatally, perinatally, and post-operatively, preserve their brain, limit the amount of damage that happens, and for me, how do we limit the neurodegenerative process that happens over time? And I think things like that, obviously you're working on sort of having sort of these devices that give us real-time data, and more importantly, how some of these things start then working in sort of a machine learning agentic pathway that will allow them to integrate with extracorporeal support, I think is going to be revolutionary to the care of these patients. And that, with the ability to have diagnostic potential of these neuroimaging, and I use that as a general term, like how we get a general sense of the brain when it's at risk, and more importantly, so that we can also start integrating real true therapeutic trials. Right now, there is no therapy. We don't use therapeutic trials because we don't have outcome metrics. We're not like the cancer field where if you have a new renal tumor, that you get biomarkers of the tumor, you have imaging, we understand it, and you can do a real adaptive trial design. And so without things like blood biomarkers and optical devices and those sort of things, we can't even do what the cancer nursery is doing yet. We can't create monoclonal antibodies that will inhibit microglial degradation over time that improve white matter health and repair. And they all kind of fit together. So the fields are all really combined, because once we have these devices that are not just changing out, you know, a valve or allow us to create blood, more or less blood flow, but we really start to understand what's happening within the brain in a continuous manner, so that we can either intervene from a physical standpoint, whether that's changing their overall critical care and changing their blood flow and changing oxygenation, but also tell us when we have therapy 1, 2, or 3, whether that is a gene therapy, a smaller molecule or a large molecule like monoclonal antibody, can tell us, hey, we've got a blood test that tells us we're still leaking glial breakdown products into the peripheral vascular system, and the what we implemented didn't work. So we need to try drug B, C, or D, or change our this or that, and we can adapt to that. Until you can do that, it comes down to the one thing that everybody forgets: no one will pay for it. Venture capital is not interested. Pediatrics is a wasteland for people. We want to believe in our heads that people truly want to fund these things because it's important for children. But ultimately, to commercialize any of these things that then really have an effect on our kids, you have to create a market for it. And we in pediatrics have not done a very good job in general creating markets and understanding the business aspect of that, because ultimately the speed to translation comes from a venture capital room that provides the equity to speed those things through. And that's where we as a general system in this country need to really start to focus on.
Very well said, and I have to say I completely agree about the neuroprotection and focusing on the brain, because I think us as anesthesiologists, that's where we can really contribute to device development for these patients. The cardiologists and the surgeons, you know, they're doing a lot with work with non-invasive or cath-based procedures, yeah. But looking at neuromonitoring is definitely our area of expertise. Okay.
And anesthesiologists are thinking about the brain all the time,
right?
And they want the tools to then make good decisions about it, instead of just, until we go through this, well, we got them through the case, right? To, we got them through the case, plus we did a lot of really good things for their brain that day. That will lead a lot of people going home at the end of the day feeling really good about their jobs, what they're doing. And to me, that's where really wellness is. We talk a lot of bullshit about wellness and all these type of things, but nobody does this. Nobody does cardiac anesthesia and these type of jobs because they are concerned about their paycheck or any of these other things, or getting breaks, or, you know, getting a free massage like next to the cafeteria for whatever blah blah wellness is. They want to feel like they left at the end of the day and they hit it out of the park, that they did the best thing they could possibly do for that individual patient that they were entrusted to take care of. And that's what I think device development, therapeutics, and diagnostics create for us, and these industry partners create for us. They create it is the wellness program for us. It's not the free pizza. It's not, you know, departmental values or whatever we say. It is, did I leave today after I just gave my blood and soul to what I do, and I feel good about it? and the ability to pull an arrow out of the quiver that we have to make decisions and implement decisions to save these kids' brains while the surgeons are working on saving their hearts is, I think, the next 20, 30 years of doing this job. And that will be the true wellness around someone that's a junior faculty member now. Their true wellness will not come from all these blah, blah, blah. It will come that they have the tools to make a difference in what they did that day. And when they leave, they feel like, holy shit, I did a really good job today and I made a difference. Nothing else.
Well, I think that is a great note to end on. I'm feeling very motivated to go back to work. So that was great. Thank you so much for talking with us today. That was wonderful.
Awesome.
Thank you.